'Tis strange how my head runs on. 'Tis a puzzle to understand such fancies stirring in me for a whiff of hay in the Strand. I see the old farmhouse, the garden wall and the bees. I see the mowers stretched with their bottles under the trees. I hear the little brook a ripple down in the dell. I hear the old folk croon, "How, son, he's doing well." Oh, yes, I am doing well. But I'd be again for a day a simple farmer's lad among the girls in the hay.
The city clerk in that poem was able to do well in his London lodgings for a few shillings a week at the turn of the century. Nowadays, with rents sky high in the capital and with transport greatly improved, more and more people are travelling into work from the country, 450,000 a day on British Rail's network Southeast alone. Mind you, not all of them would agree that that service has improved.
I can recall when trains left Cannon Street or Charing Cross and got to my station, Ashford. In under the hour, they dropped down pretty well non-stop. Now, because the Southeast has become such a commuter paradise, we now have at least five stations which carry a sufficiently large commuter population to require the train to stop there on almost all services. And it's quite normal now to stop not less than three times, and it may stop up to seven times. So in a sense, we've had the effect of slowing down the service rather than accelerating it, though the railway would argue about servicing more people.
Lord Deeds, better known as Bill Deeds, because he's that sort of man, is former editor of the Daily Telegraph and a former MP. I've seen him on my local platform for years.
I've been a commuter from Ashford Station in Kent, roughly since 1945. I must be the most hardened, if not the most senior, commuter on that bit of the line. Oddly enough, I have extraordinarily few acquaintances. Those of us who travel respect each other's privacy. People know that I want to read the papers. I have various methods now in which I can terminate the conversation just inside 30 seconds. I carry at least five daily broadsheet newspapers with me, and I do it by rustling them and looking furtively at them, and we'll be astonished how quickly that chokes off the fellow who wants to know whether you aren't related to some cousin of his who lives in Shropshire.
I remember fairly fondly what I like to think of as the good old days when on the 1900 or 7 p.m. train from Charing Cross there was a small, extremely crowded, I have to say, buffet. I used to call it the 1900 Club. In fact, rather the opposite to your technique was employed. I think we were pretty gregarious. You were never tempted to be part of that.
Well, I go back further than that. I can remember when you could take dinner on the way down from London. There was a restaurant car. Then it was reduced to a buffet bar, which was not always a pleasure to join. And now it's a man with a trolley service who has peculiar difficulties if we travel in one of the Network Southeast most abominable carriages, which are three seats one side and two the other, and woe betide you if you have a second or third customer sitting on either of them.
Although he's no longer editor, Lord Deeds still writes prolifically for The Telegraph. But the paper's now moved from Fleet Street to the famous White Elephant of Canary Wharf in London's Docklands. Wouldn't it be nicer, especially at this time of year, to cut out that long trek and write from home?
As a journalist, I made up my mind some time ago that it isn't possible to enjoy your garden half the day and write the other half. And I'm talking my type of journalism for a daily newspaper, which involves comment and editorials and so on. If you want to write in a fashion which people will find interesting, I think you must involve yourself in the daily work of the newspaper. The 5 hours that I spend traveling aren't wasted because I spend a great part of them reading the daily newspapers, which is part of my job. And it's easier to do it in a railway train where the telephones don't yet ring, and down with men who carry portable telephones in railway trains. And there is always a book to review or something, literature to be read on the way home.
And do you think this makes up for what, let's face it, can be a less than pleasant experience, particularly when the railways, as they sometimes do, don't quite come up to scratch?
I try never to take these chows home with me, unless I'm an hour late for supper, which occasionally happens on Network Southeast. I try ever to avoid telling my wife or my family of my woeful experiences on the railway trains. I think it puts a strain on married life.
Well, not surprisingly, after such a long time, Lord Deeds has got commuting down to a fine art, which is more than a lot of people have. I honestly don't know which is worse, the winter, when you leave home and arrive back, both in total darkness, after shivering on a freezing platform, or the summer, when you stand on that same platform in the warm early sunshine, surrounded by the scents of summer and birdsong, in the full knowledge that the yellow-faced monster is on its way to carry you to a sweltering city. But when the tired commuter finally steps out of his train on a summer evening, he can look forward to a peaceful stroll through the countryside. Or can he?
That flowering elderberry is there. Well, legally, that footpath should be marked at the edge of the road with a finger post pointing down to the direction of the footpath. Now, that footpath is absolutely invisible to anybody walking down this road. And on the other side of those trees, you'll find that there's a cereal crop there, which has not been restored. So there's no way that anybody would know that there was a footpath there, and there would no way, without a map, they would know what direction it went.
The path in question, or rather where the path would have been if there were one, was only a few yards away from the pub, where I was eavesdropping on a meeting of members of the Ramblers Association and the chairman of the Dover and Thanet Rights of Way Society, David Pennington. Why have a Rights of Way Society, I asked? Surely Rights of Way were, well, just there.
Well, if there weren't people like ourselves, they wouldn't be there. And a lot of them aren't there for the average member of the public, because a large percentage in this area aren't walkable for people because the line of the path is obscured as a result of ploughing or cropping. Some farmers are excellent in the way that they reinstate the paths and they waymark the paths and make walkers welcome. Some farmers try to pretend that the paths haven't been walked for years, which, of course, is a situation they'd like to keep going.
The area David was talking about is quite away from the Elam Valley. As far as I know, we don't have too many problems with access, and nearly all the footpaths and the bridle paths are well marked. George Palmer at Parsonage Farm is happy to have people on his land, but, and there is a but...
I'm not against them at all. I quite like them to enjoy the countryside. It is the ones that exercise their rights that always raise the hackles on the back of my neck. Because the footpaths were created by men, women and children that lived, worked in the countryside 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. They had no need of leisure paths. All they wanted was the quickest route to and from their home, to their work, to their shops, to their church, to their pub, to their school. And when they went out, they looked for the straightest route they could find. If it was rough grazing and pasture land, they went cateways across it. If it was arable, they kept to the foragers, because they wouldn't want to trample down the crop, because they was going to have to actually live off that crop. If they trampled down wheat, they'd done away with their bread. They trampled down oats, they done away with their porridge. They trampled down barley, they done away with their beer. No one does away with his beer, does he?
Perish the thought. Now, we need a pause for translation from the Kentish here. When George says caterways, he means diagonally across the field. And when he says foraker, or foreacre, he means the edge of the field which is left unploughed, what's called a headland in some parts of the country. The Ramblers pointed out that some farmers don't leave any unploughed, and that's not their only problem.
Oh, yes. There are a number of cases still where there are barbed wire fences. We also get the hardcore of people who create a physical obstruction themselves, and they'll suddenly emerge with their dog or a gun and behave in really quite a threatening fashion. But fortunately, that is rather less now than it used to be.
Needless to say, George Palmer's never been one of that brigade, but there have been times when he's been sorely tried.
Now, I went and bought a new ram on a Thursday, put him in with a lot of sheep, and next to him was another two rams running with another lot of sheep, and some walkers must have gone through, left the gate ajar. He pushed the gate open, got in with the other two rams, and they killed him. So he was a very expensive ram. Another annoying thing, they have the advantage that if they find something that's wrong, they can go home, they can write about it a week later, a month later, 6 months later, they can bring it up. And the chances are that the farmer will still be the same landowner as it was when the thing was wrong. Whereas we have to actually catch them not shutting the gate or breaking the stile or whatever it is. Then you get these booklets, you see. All right, the people who write the booklets know exactly what they're talking about. But along comes somebody who doesn't, they buy the booklet and off they go. And the booklet says you go over the stile and then you go in a northwesterly direction towards an oak tree. So they get over the stile, they don't know northwest from southeast, and they don't know an oak tree from a Californian redwood. So off they go, completely lost, until they come across something they do know, like the water mill or the pub or whatever the place is. They probably are supposed to approach it from the southeast or something, and they approach it from the west, but they get there and they go, oh, here we are, here we are, here we are. I know where we are now. And they are the type that really gets, you know, because they're miles off. I mean, I look at them sometimes when I'm on one side of the valley and see them going along, and I think to myself, thank God you're not a forward observation officer in the artillery calling down fire, because by Christ, you've wiped out your own line before you got there.
The footpath walkers, strangely enough, would tend to agree with that. They don't want to deviate from the proper route, but it's not always easy.
The problem round here is typified by the young families that you see occasionally with the Ordnance Survey maps in their hands, walking gingerly around the edges of fields when they're not sure where the line of the path is, because there's a field of corn, and they don't feel brave enough to follow the line even when they realise where it is. You've got to be a good map reader, you've got to be very sure of your legal rights, and you've got to have a good compass.
So, almost the very same words from two different viewpoints. Can the difference ever be resolved? Well, if everyone were as sensible as the people I talk to, the answer would certainly be yes. Let's hope so. And at least if there is conflict, it's nothing like what city commuter and farmer alike faced in 1940. On the 21st of June, the French army surrendered to the Germans. Nobody had told Bert Want.
We tried to catch our battalion up, but we got to Le Mans and they stopped us going any further. And they said that we wouldn't catch our battalion up, that we'd have to, you know, fight a rear guard. And we went right back to St. Nazaire. We came back on a coaler, actually, to Plymouth. There was only three of us come out, I think, the boats, because nothing else came out after that.
Right away, England, and especially Kent, because it was nearest, stood ready for invasion, including the commuter.
Mr. Brown goes off to town on the A21, but he comes home each evening and he's ready with his gun. So watch out, Mr. Hitler, you have met your match in us. If you think you can crush us, we're afraid you've missed the bus. 'Cause who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler?